Welcome back to another episode of the Country House podcast. And in this episode, we've discussed, well, if you go right back to the start of our episodes, we've discussed the different styles of country house architecture. We did a whistle-stop tour across much of time. But the question remains why those transitions occurred in style. And that's what we're going to talk about today, how these styles evolved, what caused them, were there political things that happened? And so, Jeff, how far back do we actually go to this? Where do we begin?
Thanks, Ben. I think the best place to start with this episode is where we started in our early episode on our tour of British architecture, which is the Norman Conquest. So the Romans had obviously, up until 400 AD, built great houses and villas out of stone and brick. And then during the Dark Ages, after the Romans left Britain, we saw British architecture revert back to sort of pre-Roman, very basic wooden houses. And it was only after the Norman Conquest in 1066, when William the Conqueror beat Harold at Hastings, that we saw sort of a unified architectural style across the country, and that was Norman castles and fortresses. And these, well, they were houses, but they were also military sort of barracks. But these buildings were created to both deter invasions from abroad and to deter local uprisings. So we saw great castles built out of stone across the country, into Scotland as well. Castles like Carrickfergus Castle in Ireland and Stirling Castle in Scotland, that were built with their great Romanesque arches and turrets and battlements. And they were very much politically driven as a deterrent to remind people of the power of the king. And then we saw a transition from Norman architecture, we talked about this in our previous episodes, into sort of slightly less fortified houses with the end of the feudal system, and King John signing the Magna Carta and so forth. We began, houses didn't have to be quite so fortified. So we saw Tudor houses popping up in the 1400s, which were sometimes moated, sometimes not, still had their basic floor plans with the central hall, with the fire in the middle and so forth. But generally they were still sort of feudal in their sort of purpose, as well as their sort of traditional building materials. And it was only really during the latter part of the Tudor period into the Elizabethan and later Jacobean periods that we saw the creation of our great country houses. And this is when we saw another example of politics speaking into our architectural styles. So I'm sure Connor can chip in here, but we've talked before about the prodigy houses during the Elizabethan era. This was when, for the first time, we had courtiers instead of generals who were the great landowners in the country. So we saw people like the Cecil family, who were great courtiers in the Tudor and Elizabethan courts, who built Burley and Hatfield houses, both of which were unfortified and were great statement houses to tell everyone of the importance of the owners and to remind everyone of their closeness to the monarch. So that was sort of these prodigy houses, and we think about them. There, Hardwick Hall was another one, Bess of Hardwick, the richest woman in England at the time. We've talked about Hardwick Hall, more glass than wall because of the number of windows in that beautiful house. But I think politically, those houses were there and were built to make a political statement and to show. And I suppose the style speaks into that, because these people also, you know, we began to see more treaties being drawn up between the UK and Europe. We saw European styles, Renaissance styles coming over into Britain. And that continued under the Jacobean and later Carolean eras.
Yes, Jeff, in that transition, we had from the fortified tower as such into the moated house and then to the country house as we know today. The architecture changed, but the rhythm of the house and some of the important rooms, such as the Great Hall, continued. So although the Great Hall was no longer in the fort, so to speak, it was in the house, at the heart of the house, and then that would have transitioned from style to style. So externally, the face does change and the composition of the building, but a lot of the characteristics that make a country house a place of authority, it was the crown, the representation of the crown in that area and responsibility for the locality, that continued through one house to the next, dependent regardless of the style. But interestingly, when we move away from the Tudors and then into the period of the Stuarts, we have, with the death of King Charles the Martyr, the period of the Civil War, when there was no houses being built. The war, of course, the war effort and spending money on arms, also not knowing whether you'd be able to hold on to your estate if you were loyal to Cromwell or loyal to the crown. But it was after the Restoration in 1660, that is when we see peace and this renewal of the country house. And as Jeff mentioned, the Carolean period. So this is Charles II in 1660, when we see houses are influenced by the Dutch tradition. So we have taller windows. We have quite large cornices, which are the moldings at where the front of the building meets the roof, so the eaves level, with dentils, and there is more decoration around the doorways. But the design we have for the Country House podcast is in fact based on this period of 1660 to 1685 during the Restoration. I'm thinking Ashdown House, Coles Hill, which is a beautiful Inigo Jones design, attributed to Inigo Jones. And we also have Belton, which is a perfectly symmetrical country house. And those houses really do symbolize that period.
I'll just jump in there, Connor, and say it's probably worth mentioning an important date in the country house architectural and political landscape is 1603, which was, of course, after the death of Queen Elizabeth. It was the ascension of James VI of Scotland to the throne as King of England. And the reason why that was significant is that was the year of the Union of the Crown, when England and Scotland formed the United Kingdom. Wales was already part of England at that point. So it was the Union of the Crown. And that was an important year because we saw Britain become more unified and more stable. And with the unification and the stability that came from that, houses could again become even grander because of the Britain becoming wealthier, but also they could become more outward looking and less fortified. So that was sort of the watershed moment when houses fully gave up being fortified completely. So even through the Tudor and Elizabethan periods, some houses were being built that were, you know, moated or had some sort of military sort of undercurrent running through their architectural style. And it was only after the Union that Britain, through its own stability, saw houses being built that were grander and totally unfortified as symbols of status and wealth. And it coincided with the invention of, refined methods of creating glass, so you could get larger panes. So windows were no longer leaded; they had wooden glazing bars. You had sash windows, which could make much bigger windows, which then led to houses becoming much lighter and brighter that we associate with houses like Belton and the other Carolean and Restoration houses. And it's also worth noting at that point as well, the Reformation, of course, played a huge part in our architectural styles. So hitherto, the Reformation, Britain was Catholic and was heavily influenced by Europe still, European style still, but the Catholic Church owned most of the land. And it was after the Reformation when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries and gave many of them to his sort of courtiers that we saw other styles. So as the churches declined, and as Britain became more isolationist as a result of damaging a relationship with Catholic Europe, it sort of coincided with the arrival of the Renaissance. So what we had is we had these clash of styles, where we had the Renaissance style, which was seen as very Catholic, coming over from Europe. But at the same time, because of the Reformation, we were seeing an aversion to that. And we saw classical and Gothic styles also being popular. And that's where we see, and Connor, you could talk more about this, the emergence of the English Baroque, which was uniquely different to European Baroque.
Yes. So the English Baroque coming after the Queen Anne style, which people are familiar with, the red brick, the white cornice, and then before that, of course, as we touched on, Coles Hill and the Caroline style, the influence of the continent, so the Dutch tradition of these tall windows and three stories with the dormers above, we are most used to today of a two-story with dormers. So this tallness that is born of the continent continued in the Baroque, English Baroque period. And this was a short-lived, sadly, because it really did give some of England's greatest country houses. And I'm thinking of Easton Neston, which is the work of Hawksmoor. And this is a remarkable house where you have a giant order, so a full Corinthian columns either side of the central front door, which is reached by a flight of stairs, which bow out from the left and right and unite again at the piano nobile in front of the front door. And the facade steps back from the center, going right and going left. It steps back with each bay. And at every junction, there is a pilaster. So you get this sense of grandness. And it appears as though it's a three-story house. But it's only when you go to the side elevation that you see the real human scale, the smaller windows, and you see it's a lot taller than it suggests in the front. So it's by using larger windows, it is suggesting it's smaller, but it is giving the sense of grandeur that a Queen Anne style didn't have. A Queen Anne style is more, I suppose, it's more country, less antiquity. So a Queen Anne style is more popular today because of that. It's more suited to the big house in the village as opposed to the Baroque for its grandeur. But Easton Neston, another famous English Baroque, is, of course, Chatsworth, which everyone knows from The Duchess, from Pride and Prejudice. And this was started in, I believe it was the 1680s, when they commenced Chatsworth. And that was built in the English Baroque style. The most famous English Baroque, of course, is 1666, Inigo Jones, St. Paul's. And although that's a church, this was an important point at which architects would have followed, and it would have influenced what was built. But the move away from English Baroque is interesting to what we're discussing in terms of how politics has influenced the country house architecture, in that with the ascendancy of the Whigs in the era of the reign of George I, there was a move against the continental styles, against, this was the Whig ascendancy, so it was a move against what was seen as Tory and continental values. The Baroque, of course, being ornate and theatrical and grand, with the Palladian being more austere and reserved, and that suited the Whig aesthetic.
Yeah, I think before we talk about the actual architectural style during the Whig ascendancy, it's perhaps helpful for our listeners to outline what motivated the Whigs politically. So you mentioned that they were in opposition to the Tories, and the Whigs were sort of pushing away from Europe in that sense. But there were more than that, in the sense that the Whigs believed that politics was more than just sort of a bum fight between different vested interests of politicians. So they believed in a politics that incorporated ethics, art, and aesthetics. Their politics emphasized things like social duty, moderation, tolerance, stoicism, which of course is a classical philosophy, which is perhaps why they were so drawn to the classical simplicity of Palladianism and classicism, decency, virtues, a distrust of anything that was sort of over-enthusiastic or vigorous in its sort of style. So the most ostentatious architecture we saw was just pre the Whig ascendancy with the English Baroque. And then we saw that shift away as the Whigs took over as the primary party in the British Parliament, with this sense of stoicism and moderation.
Yes, a perfect example of this transition from the English Baroque, the theatrical, the embellished, to the more restrained and I suppose more refined classical is Wentworth Woodhouse, which we had an earlier episode. It was in, I think it was in the 1720s that Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Stratford, had completed the Baroque house that stands behind the Wentworth Woodhouse we know today. And it's amazing that this was completed at this transition point. Now, of course, the Wentworths were Whigs, and of course, to be in line with the rest of their party, so to speak, they changed from the Baroque house. They built a new house at the front, which we see today, which was built in 1734, and that was Henry Flitcroft, the architect. This house completely screens the Baroque house behind, and it is, I suppose, similar to Wanstead, which no longer exists, another grand country house, but it symbolizes perfectly this Whig sense of restraint, but also it's a powerful house. So you have a grand portico supported by Corinthian columns that steps down onto five or four bays across, balustrade on top, urns in the corner. It's a stone-faced building. There's a grand hall at its center, similar to what we've mentioned earlier about the Great Hall continuing from the castle to the moated house and going forward through the ages, the significance of having the Great Hall, a place to meet, a place to entertain guests, a place to speak. And it's in a way the public internal face of the house. Anyone visiting is entering into this entrance hall. But Wentworth Woodhouse, continuing with its description, it steps down again into lower bays, into wings, which extend to end pavilions. And these end pavilions, they have rustication, coins on the corners. They bookend this long facade, and they are surmounted by cupolas, which are clock tower-shaped structures with finials on top, and they perfectly frame the house within its parkland setting.
I'm interested from this how these influences came about, and I know we've talked about that, but I think it would be helpful to get more in detail just from you both as an insight into that we transition the styles and suddenly this style comes about. But what's actually happening on the ground with the architects? For example, you mentioned earlier, Connor, about the Dutch influence, which I found really interesting, and noting what you were talking about from the transition to Catholicism to Protestantism, and how the Netherlands was like us in its Protestant state, which perhaps could be the reason why we imported much of their architecture. But what is actually, how did the transitions actually go ahead? Am I making sense there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of different aspects to that, Ben. So for example, let's touch on the Dutch influence. So what we saw in Europe in that period was the persecution of the Huguenots by the Catholics. So the Dutch Protestants were being persecuted for their For their faith. And so they fled, and you saw them going down to the Cape, which is why you get Cape Dutch architecture from the 17th and 18th centuries in and 16th centuries, sorry, 17th and 18th centuries in South Africa. But we also saw them coming across to many ports and sort of seaside towns in the UK, which is why, for example, Topsham in Devon, which is on an estuary on the River Exe, has a significant Dutch influence because the Dutch traders, the Huguenot traders, came over and then sometimes established themselves and didn't leave because of the persecution going on in Europe. So you see Dutch gables. Likewise, in Norfolk and Suffolk especially, which of course is just across the sea from the continent, we see, again, the Dutch influence more keenly. So houses like Raynham Hall, Marquess Townsend's extraordinary red brick house in Norfolk, with its Dutch gables, as well as its slightly Baroque facade, it sort of amalgamated various periods and styles. But so that was sort of touching on the Dutch aspect that you mentioned, Ben. That was sort of one of the political undercurrents that drove us to embrace a Dutch style in the UK. I think regarding the shift from Baroque to Palladianism, that was clearly a shift that happened at the end of the Stuart rule. So the Baroque style, with its sort of over-the-top embellishments, was associated with Toryism, and that in turn was associated with continental Europe and Catholicism. And as the aristocracy became increasingly Whig in its politics, the mood shifted to the more stripped back orthodoxy of British Palladianism that was popularized by Colin Campbell, for example, the great country house architect and writer who wrote Vitruvius Britannicus, which is a brilliant volume on British domestic architecture. So Baroque aesthetics, which were mostly influenced and incredibly potent in the mid 17th century in France, actually made little impact in England. And because we never saw Baroque ever take hold, or Rococo, for example, in the same way that it did in Europe, because Britain was by that point Protestant. And although we had a shift back towards Catholicism under Charles I and Charles II and the emergence of English Baroque, it never firmly took hold, because Catholicism never firmly took hold back in Britain. And so as Britain became increasingly Protestant in its values, so that Protestant puritanical mindset that undergirded British values was sort of seeped into our domestic architecture.
So was this coming more from the owner and the one who desired to have this house and send a signal of their values and have the house indicative of what they wanted to come across as? Or was this more the inspiration of architects reflecting the period?
I think it was both, Ben. You know, Connor is an architect. He can attest to this. Architects work closely with their patrons, with those who commission them. And it's sort of not even a compromise. I mean, these days, I suppose, architects... it varies. I imagine these days, you know, someone will commission an architect because they like the style they already do and will trust that they'll build something in that style. So I imagine with Connor, if he gets a client, they'll commission him because they know that he builds in a classical or Palladian or Georgian style. Whereas in those days, we also saw the emergence of the amateur gentleman architect, because many of these aristocratic landowners had done the Grand Tour. The Grand Tour was rising in popularity during the late 17th and early 18th centuries. They had seen these great classical buildings in Italy and Greece and other places. And so they came back with their own keen ideas on what to build.
Yes, and Jeff, continuing from that point of why did the patron decide on a certain style? It was the trendsetters. So even thinking of today, building a country house, there might be an architect, Quinlan Terry, Ben Pentry, George Samuels Smith, to name a few, who build a very beautiful, successful country house for perhaps someone of importance that other people look to. So in this case, we have Thomas Wentworth, the Earl of Stratford, who was an important man within the Whig ascendancy, the Whig nobility. And in order to follow, there would be patrons who would look to Wentworth Woodhouse as the trend to follow. So that would be a trendsetter, so to speak. But as also Jeff has mentioned with the Grand Tour, Henry Flitcroft, who designed Wentworth Woodhouse, he was also involved in Stourhead in the Follies. And the Temple of Baalbek in modern-day Lebanon was the influence for that. So it was always looking to the classical world. Antiquity is the genesis, it is the precedent, and these have fallen to ruin. But as custodians holding the mantle of civilization, it is a sense of duty to pick up where things left off. And although this is now stands as a ruin in Baalbek, its beauty, its composition, it's timeless. And so there is an urge and a motivation to continue that, but also show education, learnedness, that you have been to these places and it's done correctly. That is, so in terms of getting the right architect, that's important as much then as it is now.
That's helpful. Thanks, Connor. I think, you know, we saw the emergence of these gentleman architects as well, who had a huge influence over who in many ways were architects, because in those days, architects were artists in many ways, you know. Architects in the 17th and 18th centuries, Connor, you can confirm if I'm correct or not, but architects would essentially design a beautiful building, but they didn't know all the nitty gritty. They would get their engineers and so forth to do all that. So people like Lord Burlington, who designed Chiswick House, that great Villa Rotunda in West London, he wouldn't have done what a modern architect today does of, you know, designing how the dome is supported and all that. He would have just drawn the Villa Rotunda and got the builders and the architects and the draftsmen to make it work. Is that fair, Connor?
Well, the term architect, before it was called that, as we know today, it was the master builder. So in a way, it's rather than an expert of a single trade, it is a general knowledge of all that are involved on the site, knowing a bit about the plumbing, a bit about the carpentry, and so on. And of course, it would have all been hand-drawn. But the education of the architect was incredibly important on the execution, the style of the architecture. So we see how the Grand Tour into Rome and the ancient world influenced the country house in England. But in turn, when Napoleon had his blockade, it meant that the Grand Tour could not continue on its traditional route. And the effect of this on architecture, on the country house, was that in the 1830s, the ramification following the education of architects who would have had to go to Greece rather than Rome, rather than Italy. We see in the 1830s and 1840s, country houses, late Regency, if you want, in style, crisp, fine lines, very few decorations or ornament on the facade. It may have three mouldings to the cornice, an architrave around the windows, which have a simple cornice on their edge rather than stepping within the architrave. So there's a great simplicity, and you see the Ionic portico rather than the Corinthian. So it's a more restrained architecture, and that was direct influence of Greece, but coming from the political ramifications of Napoleon's blockade.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Connor. I think I found a great quote by Colin Campbell, the Scottish architect who wrote Vitruvius Britannicus, as I mentioned, and who also who designed some of our greatest country houses. He designed Stourhead, Wanstead, which is now destroyed, Burlington House, which was later remodeled, and Pembroke House, which was sadly knocked down. But this quote that I found by Colin Campbell talking about the excesses of Baroque, because Colin was perhaps the architect for the early Whigs, was this wonderful quote where he declared that the Italians had lost all taste for architecture in the pursuit of capricious novelties. And of the Italian architects, he said, Borromini was the basest of all. He had endeavoured to debauch mankind with his odd and chimerical beauties, where the parts are without proportion, solids without their true bearing, heaps of materials without strength, excessive ornamentation without grace, and the whole without symmetry. So that's Colin Campbell being very rude about the extravagance of Baroque. And of course, he then pioneered classicism, more restrained classicism and Palladianism in the UK.
Interestingly, that Colin Campbell did say that, but Wentworth Woodhouse, which was commenced in the 1680s, which is English Baroque, does feature in his Vitruvius Britannicus.
But so does so many others. So did
yes.
Castle Howard and many of Vanbrugh's other ones. I think Vitruvius Britannicus.
Grimsthorpe as well.
I think Grimsthorpe as well, yes. So
yes.
Vitruvius Britannicus was his drawings of country houses, but in his writings, he was very rude about Baroque.
Right.
Referred and erred towards Palladianism and simple classicism. But just thinking, Connor, you mentioned how through the Regency period, we saw simpler and cleaner buildings being built. And we see that in the crescents in Bath. We see that in London townhouses. But then we had a turning point at the start of the Victorian era where we saw great enormous Gothic houses popping up all over the place. Perhaps, Connor, you can explain a little more about why there was this shift from clean classical lines of Palladianism and Georgian and Regency houses through to,
yes,
again, this extravagance of neo-Gothic.
When you look at architecture on the whole, you do see reactions in the sense of we go through a period of perhaps austere refinement, and the reaction to that is something more ornate and more handmade. I'm thinking of the transition from the Victorian to the 20th century with the arts and crafts, but moving from the Regency, which was most recognizably quite refined, perfectly proportioned houses, white in color, and Ionic porticos rather than Corinthian. Moving from that to the Victorian, when we think of a Victorian house, we imagine the red brick and the banding of darker and lighter color bricks to create patterns on the wall. We think of stone dressings, whether they be the coins on the corners or the windowsills or perhaps a stone base. You'll always have a stone base. The brick will never sit on the moist ground. The stone base keeps the brick from decaying and raises it above the ground. But also internally and externally, the introduction of more ornament, which was lacking and or rather just not present as much in the Regency. Ornament really coming back in the Victorian period. And this was also a time with the Industrial Revolution of industrialists making a fortune and building a house to say, I've arrived, and they're putting their stamp down and they're building their dynasty, so to speak. And that house is the beginning of that. And so these houses separate themselves from what came before. You'll often find smaller rooms. I think in Victorian country houses, you might enter into the stair hall, which is grand and colorful. There's tiles, there's repeated patterns. But how this differs to the Regency before that, the Regency would have a very simple cornice on the ceiling, where the ceiling meets the wall. You would have perhaps simple tiling or flagstone floors or timber floor. Now, in the Victorian, there's smaller rooms. It's more cozy. And this was a reaction to the austerity of that Regency style. But perhaps, Jeff, you could talk on the fact that this was perhaps a more British, a more English style of architecture, which was in complete alignment with the sense of patriotism and the development of empire.
Yes, I think that's right. I think, you know, as the empire expanded to become what was the largest empire history has ever seen, so British sort of pride in being British and being part of the empire meant that there was a sort of turning back to what is British in architecture. And so there was this sort of English take on Gothic that we saw a revival of in the Victorian era, which linked also with, again, the sort of during the Industrial Revolution, which meant that things became much cheaper to make because of mass production. At the same time, we saw these patrons turning towards traditional craftsmanship as a means of sort of countering that. So people like William, we saw in the latter part of the Victorian era, the likes of William Morris, for example, and John Ruskin, trying to reform the pre-industrial manufacturing tectonics and giving craftsmen occupations. So, and that continued into the early 20th century with the arts and crafts movement. So it's interesting as well, you know, obviously the Victorian houses, we saw these additions to often to classical houses with Victorian additions that were added on to later date because of the wealth that the empire brought and the increase in staffing and so forth. But at the same time, this sort of the political landscape was changing because there were more houses across the land. So with the emergence of sort of the nouveau riche industrial class, we saw the creation of new estates. So some of the older estates sold off some of their land and created new estates. And so suddenly we saw more and more, or small manor houses were knocked down and created and replaced by grand Victorian neo-Gothic piles. So Britain's role in the world was changing rapidly, and so was the landscape of British country houses.
Yes, the houses, I suppose you could say, was looking further back into British history rather than looking into Italy and the ancient world. That in Victorian country houses, you will often see turrets on the corners and a more Northern European influence, castellation, and this accentuation of the Gothic, the pointed arch. It was also the period now with Queen Victoria and the royal family, rather than, of course, before Queen Victoria. Sorry, I'm going to cut that part. Anyway, let me come in again on, yes. With Queen Victoria and the royal family, you have the building of a family image for the household. We think of Prince Albert and the introduction of the Christmas tree, and back to Osborne House. Osborne, of course, is Italianate, so it's not in the Victorian tradition that we think of with the red brick and the revival of an English style, but it is internally more cozier size family domestic rooms rather than larger, as the Regency had, more stately size rooms, more classical, more of antiquity. These were of a smaller, perhaps warmer proportion. And that's reflected in the Victorian houses we see. It's interesting that more people are interested in Georgian houses, and there is the Georgian group, but there's also the Victorian Society. But perhaps Georgian houses are more popular today because of period dramas, but they're also older, and there's more than romance for them.
That's helpful. And we can think about how that sort of romanticism that we saw in the Victorian era of sort of looking back to the past and being inspired by the original Gothic buildings in Britain in the after the Norman Conquest, sort of in the sort of 1300s, we saw Gothic architecture become commonplace in Britain in ecclesiastical architecture, and that was mirrored later in Victorian architecture. And then we emerge into the Edwardian period, which really was sort of the start of the modern era, in the sense that the latest mod comms, electricity, telephones, and so forth were easily accessible to the wealthiest in society. And so what you see is you see people building houses that have become known as pastiche, but of course all architectural styles are pastiche because they all draw elements from the past. A Georgian house at the time was pastiche because it was copying the classicism of ancient Rome and Italy. So when people fire accusations at Quinn and Terry or George Somery Smith or Ben Pentreath for designing modern classical houses in the 21st century and say they're pastiche, well, people were saying the same about Lord Burlington and Colin Campbell and others in the 17th and 18th centuries. But perhaps the most common accusation that's thrown against Edwardian architecture about pastiche is the so-called mock Tudor that we saw the emergence of. So Tudor style or mock classical or mock Gothic. So so mock Tudor, we saw, you know, beams with a white sort of imitation wattle and daub in between the Tudor beams. But Edwardian architecture was mainly attacked for combining the old with the new. So you might have had a sort of a Jacobean garage with a beamed sitting room and an electric gate. But that was the point about Edwardian architecture, was that it had all the mod cons contained within a house that also boasted all the greatest elements of ancient British architecture. It's quite a hodgepodge mix of architectural styles, and that gave rise to the arts and crafts movement as well. But we see this sort of strange marrying of different architectural styles in the Edwardian period. I think in Country Life it said back in the early 20th century, Country Life magazine published an article about Edwardian architecture and talking about a house that was built that was mock Tudor. Said no trouble or expense has been spared in appointing and fitting the laundry with every modern contrivance. And at Jardine Hall in Dumfries, the Palladian house had a room added to accommodate the latest Victorian craze for playing snooker. So again, with the rise in wealth and so forth, we see this this adding on and this sort of British styles, or perceived to be British styles, onto maybe European looking houses.
Well, this is exactly what architects have been doing for centuries, for millennia, which is taking the best from the past and marrying it with what is the most, I suppose, contemporary comfort. So we look at, when building a classical country house today, we might look to a 1720s, because that's a particularly beautiful period for the early Palladian, and you have this crisp, beautifully proportioned red brick country house with stone dressings and a slate roof with tall chimneys. And the client looks at this and says, I really want something like that. And of course they can, but you can have with that modern comforts. It's going to have all the electrics and plumbing and conveniences that you'd expect of today with the beauty of the past. So you're bringing what works forward and leaving behind what doesn't work. And it means that today, of course, then you can have your sash windows, your tall ceilings, your beautiful cornices and tiled entrance hall. But also under that entrance hall, there's underfloor heating, which of course didn't exist in 1730. You can have insulation in the paneling of the window shutters for the sash, or double glazing. All these things are possible, yet you are designing in the tradition and in the beauty that you love of the past.
Well, that's fascinating. And I must say it's so interesting to listen to you both talk about this, especially what mostly fascinates me is how the architecture of the time is indicative of the type of Britain it was, based on everything that was going on at the time. And it, you know, we look back and we see often a cautious Britain, an energized Britain at times, sometimes a confident Britain, and we see how that is reflected in the architecture. And it begs the question of how people in the future will look back and define the era that we're currently in, and how that will be remembered or reflected on. But thank you for joining us again, and we hope you have a great week, and see you next week. Goodbye.